Well, good to be with you again, and just keep grappling with you with this this great and fascinating book, the Paul's Letter to the Romans. The reasons for unbelief are many and varied. We live in a country where, according to a recent survey, about 50% of Australians believe in some kind of classical Christianity. About 50% don't. It seems to be stubbornly stuck around there. And on the other 50%, you have variables on what people do and don't believe, how they pull it all together. But certainly, unbelief in traditional Christianity is widely felt in our culture. Some of the reasons, as you know, are intellectual, and the recent atheist convention in Melbourne has grappled with the intellectual objections to Christian belief. But many, and I suspect these are the ones that bring more people unstuck than the intellectual, are the personal or emotional reactions to experiences with or among Christians or ideas about what Christians are like. And I think in that experience, in those objections to faith, those barriers to faith, I think the experience of hypocrisy is one of the most powerful forces that undoes Christian faith, or even stands at the door of Christian faith and says it's not worth walking in here because of the problem of hypocrisy. Sometimes our reaction to hypocrisy is so visceral and primal that it doesn't need evidence. Just the suggestion or thought that someone somewhere is hypocritical is enough to sink a journey toward faith. But for others, we have to acknowledge, tragically, it's unfortunately grounded in real, verifiable experience of the actual hypocrisy of religious people. Well, we're looking at this letter to the Romans, and Paul is giving this book to describe the righteousness of God. The question that drives the book is the question of the righteousness of God, which catches out in three ways for the people he's speaking to. Is God righteous? Will God be shown to be righteous? Secondly, how can I be righteous? How can I know a right relationship with God? And thirdly, how will God be made righteous in relationship to the world? How will the world be justified? How will everything line up? And Paul's book of Romans is written really to address those questions. Will God be shown to be righteous? Can I be righteous with God? And will God make the world right again? Last week we started following the argument proper, the argument of Romans, and Paul began by looking at the world in general in its rebellion against its creator. Paul begins the argument by locating the problem of the human condition in the human heart, which has rejected its God. According to Romans, there's no such thing as an atheist, really. We all know God, but suppress the knowledge of the truth of God. And as any good psychologist will tell you, when you suppress things, that's an unhealthy strategy because they come up again in strange and difficult ways. And Romans says that the suppressed knowledge of God comes up again in a strange and difficult way in the worship of things that aren't God, in the worship of things that are less than us. So humans, made to worship a God greater than us, in our rebellion against that God, don't worship nothing, we worship anything, and end up worshipping things that are less than us rather than giving credit to the Creator. There was a great film of the late 1960s called The Endless Summer. Has anyone come across this film? It's a classic of the big boards, the kind of just the post-Malibu era of, I think they're kind of 9-foot boards, aren't they? And these guys travelled across the world in this first great surf film. And they came through America, California, South Africa. They even came through Perth. And in the film went surfing down at Ocean Beach in Denmark. Anyway, it's a fantastic film. And at the end of the film does what films always do. They give honour and praise to the people to whom honour and praise is due. So at the end of this film, it's no different. The credits, that's what the credits are, honour and praise. And the credits gave honour and praise to the actors, the producers, the directors, the guy who did the gaffer tape, the guy who did the catering. Everyone got credit where credit was due. It was interesting at the end of this film, as the credits were rolling up, they felt like they had to give credit to whoever it was that made the scene, because they had organised the gaffer tape and the catering and the film and all that kind of thing, so you knew who to thank, but they'd been surfing on waves that they hadn't made, they'd been to coastal scenarios that they hadn't created, They had seen mountains and valleys that weren't their making. And so they feel this need to thank someone. And so the last credit in the Endless Summer is we thank Neptune, god of the sea. And it's a classic statement of the human condition. Suppressing the knowledge of God, but somehow knowing that someone somewhere deserves thanks. And I think we know that. It's a very cold person, I think we said on the first week, who can sit there at the OBH at Cottesloe and look out over a sunset and just to see the sun sink over the horizon and not feel in themselves somewhere, do you know what? Someone somewhere deserves thanks for this. Someone has done me good and I should thank them. Well, that's how Paul talks about the suppressed knowledge of God. And it expresses itself, he says, in immorality. And he talks about the nature of our refusing to give God thanks, of being handed over by God to our own evil desires, and so on. It's a classic Jewish view of the world around you. Paul's a Jewish man. He never ceases being Jewish as he becomes Christian, as I trust anyone who becomes Christian ought not cease to be Jewish, if they are. Paul doesn't cease to be Jewish as a Christian, and he looks out over the world and gives the classic Jewish objection to paganism, worshipping created things rather than the Creator. And the whole way through, as he lists pagan immorality of sexual immorality and financial immorality and so on, he talks about them. He says, they. There's not once in chapter 1 where he implicates himself or his listeners. He's talking about the world out there. And I think he's trying to trick us. You see, the whole way through that section, he talks about them, and says, they're bad, they're evil, they've suppressed the knowledge of God, they worship idols. And the whole way through, if you're a religious person, you're getting enticed and thinking, yeah, they're foolish, they're immoral, they're unrighteous. But then, chapter 2, verse 1, you therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment. See what's happened with the video camera? It's right there showing you the world, and you're the little religious, not you, but one is the little religious community looking out at the world like the kind of, you know, behind the 6-foot fence with the barbed wire, and saying this is a terrible world out there, and suddenly the camera is on us, on the religious people. It says, you've got no excuse, you who pass judgment, because you who condemn others do the same thing. Now, of course, he doesn't mean the same things literally, but the same sorts of things. The things that happen out there are also the things, says Paul, that happen in here. And religion has failed to be the answer to the problem of human righteousness. I think it was last year, wasn't it, that the case blew up on the FM radio station where the two radio presenters were interviewing the girl, 14 years old. Her mother was there. She's strapped to a lie detector. And they start asking questions and it's all kind of FM radio comedy about her sex life and so on. And it turns out that a very horrible thing had happened to this girl, which happened live in Sydney. And Australia, which is a country that sees itself as a kind of tolerant, secular country, suddenly realised that it did have a taste for morality and judgment after all. And so if you were here in Australia for that few weeks, there was this chorus of litany of judgment against these hosts for what they had done. And it's quite right, because it was an exploitative and wrong thing to do. But I think it taught us two things. Firstly, that Australians do have a taste for judgment, and when sufficiently prodded, they'll get up and say, no, that is actually wrong. I think the other striking thing was who the judgment was coming from. It was coming from shows like A Current Affair. Shows like Today Tonight, that is, shows that make all their money from shoving cameras into the face of renters and ethnic minorities and making a mockery of them at 6:30 on a weeknight on television. It was channels, like Channel 10 is the one that sacked the guy, Carl, right? This is the same Channel 10 that gave us Big Brother. It's the same Channel 10 that after midnight allows the advertising of pornography that can be sent to your mobile. And some of the advertising about pornography says that our stuff is barely legal. That is, that the girls are so young that it's almost illegal. That's Channel 10. And they're the ones that sacked him. And so what Paul is saying and what the gospel is saying is, sure, there needs to be judgment, but at whatever point you judge others, be careful that you are, that you stand under that same judgment yourself. You see, as Paul said to us before, this is a section of Paul's letter is about the sin of hypocrisy. And it's commonly said that, erroneously, I think, that all sins are the same, that the Bible teaches all sins are the same. I don't think that's true. And in fact, if Jesus is anything to go by, religious hypocrisy is way up there as among the worst, if not the worst thing that you can do, to be a religious hypocrite. You think about the life of Jesus, the way he gravitated to the tax collectors and the sinners, and the words that he reserved of judgment were for those who, to quote him, tied up heavy burdens on people but did not lift a finger themselves to carry them. Jesus was serious about hypocrisy. You may have heard the saying that the church is, people say the church is full of hypocrites, and Christians sometimes say in response, there's plenty of room for more. Now, that's kind of a cutesy saying, but I don't think it really captures the heart of what the Bible is saying about hypocrisy and religious hypocrisy in particular. See, Paul addresses first the moral person that has responded to chapter 1 with that kind of judgment and says, well, you also stand under the same judgment yourself. He judges moral religion. And finally, from verse 17, which we've not had a chance to read, but I can take you through, he condemns the person that stands not on their moral performance, but on their tribal allegiance. In verse 17, he says, if you call yourself a Jew, rely on the law and boast in God, if you know his will and approve what's superior because you're instructed by the law, if you're convinced that you're blind to the guide and so on. He says, as it's written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Now, here, I think this whole section of Romans, section 1 and 2, is really a quest for silence. It's a quest for Paul to answer every objection and silence it so that we can finally hear God's solution to our problem. He thinks in chapter 1 about the problem of idolatry. That first half of chapter 2, he's thinking about the problem of moral hypocrisy. And here, about tribal allegiance. Some of us have tribal allegiances like Baptist or Anglican, Church of Christ or Catholic. The Jews had a real allegiance compared to those. The Jewish one actually had a claim for it, the people of God. But what Paul is saying is that even those who did have a claim, even the Jewish people, tribal allegiance will not be the thing that saves them from the judgment of God. You see, Paul is getting rid of a very important barrier to faith. The idea, namely, that God judges according to tribal allegiance or to moral performance. It's a thing that many of you, many of the people in Australia, may object to about faith. Hypocrisy. And Paul is saying God will have none of it. The teaching of chapters 1 and 2 in Romans, in fact, is that on the day when we face God's righteousness, his assessment, his judgment of the world, then on that day, the secrets of every heart will be revealed, and the pedophile priest who has used the cover of his role to do vile things to little boys, who has escaped every court in this world, will one day face God. And on that day, his membership of the one true church will be irrelevant, and God will judge him according to what he has done. And the same is true for the evangelical pastor, for the missionary, for the Bible college graduate or lecturer, for the coordinator of the prayer group. We will all stand before the judgment of God, and our tribal badges will be irrelevant as God judges us in righteousness and truth. That's the argument, as I understand it, of Romans chapter 2. But before we leave it, I wanted you to notice one more thing. There is a ray of light in these otherwise dark and penetrating chapters. There's a person you come across here in these chapters that Paul speaks of that doesn't fit the mould. In verse 29, he talks about someone who is a Jew inwardly, talks about someone who's had a circumcision of the heart, and someone at the end who receives praise from God. Or he talks earlier about those who not only hear the law, but who obey the law, that who will be declared righteous, or the Gentiles that don't have the law, but do by nature the things that are required of the law. who is that person? Who is this person that does the law without having the law? Well, people have thought about this. One option is that it's a hypothetical person. Maybe Paul is saying here's a person that a category for which there are no actual members, a group of people that could keep the law but haven't. But I don't think that's right, because he says this is someone who doesn't have the law but keeps the law. Circumcision was part of the law. And here's someone who is uncircumcised and who yet keeps the law perfectly. Or verse 16, he says, this is what happens through Jesus Christ, as his gospel declares. It seems to be part of the gospel, not a made-up hypothetical. It could be, secondly, Paul's talking about a good pagan, someone like Aristotle, who lives a life of moral virtue in spite of not believing in God. It could include something like that, but the terms are very elevated, someone who seeks glory and honour and immortality. So I think Paul is actually talking here in chapter 2 about those who have come to faith in Jesus, about Gentile people who have known the grace and mercy of God and who have come to a new way of knowing God and existing in the world. More of that next week. The point of this chapter really is to say that God shows no favouritism. That the righteousness of God will be revealed as God judges and assesses and makes just the world, victim and oppressor, sinner and saint. All of us will have our hands over our mouths and be silent before the goodness and justice of God. Secondly, there's a hope held out there for the one who persists in seeking goodness and glory and immortality. Notice there it's not perfection. I think one of the unfair categories given to Christian people is that what's demanded from them is perfection. And here, the church, when people say the church is full of hypocrites, and they say, well, it's not, you can join and be a hypocrite with us. That's a horrible way of saying something that is true, which is to say the church isn't full of perfect people. It's a bit more like a hospital than it is like a sports clinic. Because you're there because you know that something is deeply wrong with you and your Creator, with you and your world, and you want to make amends. So of course the church isn't perfect. Of course Christians aren't perfect. But they are people who ought to persist in doing good, who persist in seeking glory and honour and immortality. It's not hypocritical to say that I am imperfect and then prove to actually be imperfect. That is to tell the truth. But neither is it acceptable for Christians to call a truce with hypocrisy and to say, I'm just going to exist in this double standard for the rest of my life. The great thing about the gospel is that there is hope for everyone, even for hypocrites. You see that those words in that early sentence? He says, do you show contempt for his kindness, forbearance and patience, not realising that God's kindness leads you toward repentance? We're thinking about more about God's kindness and the way it leads us to repentance in Him next week. But I think I should give a couple of minutes to take your questions and comments. Do you have any questions or comments? There we go.
Could you explain that verse 15, glory and honour and peace for everyone who does good?
It's one of the balancing acts that Paul has to run through the whole book of Romans, is that God doesn't show favouritism, and yet it is Jew first and then Gentile. And that whole idea that the judgment be, as opposed to God being tribal and saying God's got his gang, and sorry to have to use this word, but to quote the kind of American foreign policy idea, he may be a bastard, but he's our bastard. That idea that God, perhaps God's like that, that he's got his bunch of crooks and they're still his crooks. And Paul is saying here, he's trying to work between those two ideas, that the Jews were the chosen people of God, who God has, who God works amongst, but he will not show partiality to them as regards judgment. In fact, it will be his own people first that face his assessment. I think it's that idea, but it's one of the great tensions of Romans. And I think Paul is Jewish and Christian, and he's working constantly between these two tribes. The Jews, who may be tempted to lean on their pedigree and religious history, and the Gentiles, who may be tempted to arrogance as the gospel now comes to them, And so he's constantly saying to the Gentiles, you're not, you know, you're the Johnny come latelys, but also to the Jews, don't rest on your heritage.
We had a sign outside our church a little while ago that said, this church is not full of hypocrites. There's always room for one more. The question that I'd ask is, did this passage guide the church? Did it stop the church speaking out about it? For example, there is divorce and abortion within church members. Does that stop the church speaking out?
No, that's a great question. So does this kind of thing stop the church speaking out against those things? No, I don't think it does, but it does cause us to be silent before we speak. So at the end of chapter 3, which we'll look at next week, Paul says, I've been saying this so that every mouth may be silent and the whole world held accountable before God. So I think we can and must speak about issues of righteousness and justice, but we do it circumspectly from fallen person to fallen person. Aware of where we stand in the whole thing. So I think it can be done, but it's done carefully. Yeah, absolutely. Well, just by way of encouragement, next week, Romans chapter 3 is widely regarded, and I think rightly, as perhaps the most important passage in the whole Bible, certainly in the whole book of Romans. And so I trust things will start to come together there.